This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and I have with us tonight Dr. Erwin Laszlo, and we're going to talk about one of his many books, Quantum Shift in the Global Brain. How are you, Dr. Laszlo?
Oh, I'm fine, Eva. It's very, very good to talk with you.
I tell you what, I think this is a most appropriate book for this particular interview with everything that's going on in the world right now. Thanks. Right. Thanks for coming on. And I know your son's in town, so I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. So,
no, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you. So let's just start right in. Your book talks about what's going on the Earth with the inhabitants of the Earth and problems that we're facing and gives us some solutions about fixing them. Is it too late to fix what's going on?
I don't think so. I mean, it's a hope. If it was too late, you know, we might as well just kiss our children good night, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think so. I think things can move very fast. That's the funny thing. You know, when you get to a point of what is known as a critical instability, are popularly known as a crisis, then things move fast. Both the bad things and the possibly putting it right also can move very fast. So we should be ready to be surprised, also surprised positively. We're getting surprised negatively a lot of times now, but we could also be getting surprised positively by seeing how actually people and societies can actually move quickly to put things into order, you know?
Well, let's talk about... You talk about the financial issues in this book, and since we've had, you know, this is, I play these shows more than one time sometimes, so this show is in October of 2008. We all know what just happened with our financial market. So what can you tell us about what's happened and how we could possibly change or make things better in the not-too-distant future?
Well, you know, I'm not a finance expert, so
with consciousness.
I won't give you technical details, but the general problem is general concept, you know, seeing the forest and not just abstracting from the individual trees for the time being, just seeing the overall picture. Then I think I have a fairly good grasp of that. And what is happening is something that was foreseeable, actually, for a long time. We just didn't know when it's going to happen. We have seen increasingly incoherence, a kind of thing that's happening where one part of the system is becoming quite removed, separated off from the rest. In this particular case, the investment banking system and the financial insurance system and all the loans that the banks are making on mortgages and all that has took on a life of its own. It became this. Associated entirely from the rest of society. So when this happens in an organism, you know, then you have a phenomenon that there's really a sickness. One part of the organism doesn't obey the rest, you know. If it's in the extreme case, you have a cancer, which means that a group of cells that simply don't fit itself with the rest. And here we had a situation in the financial system where the whole private banking system and the financial insurance system, the mortgage system and so on, kept operating in a world of its own, making money, but virtual money, without having any backup to it. So sooner or later, this bubble was bound to burst. We could see that. We didn't know when it's going to burst and why and what would trigger it. But many of these processes are operating in the world. When they become incoherent, when they become unreal, then it takes a pinprick, sort of, and then the thing will burst. And this is what has happened now with the subprime business.
So
I think it's a question of reestablishing, you know, bringing back this system into reality, into the economic world, into the real world, instead of operating in a virtual world of its own.
So, you know, I think I told you a few minutes ago that I received a startling email from John Peterson at the Arlington Institute that something may happen this upcoming week that could be devastating. So people are losing hope, you know. Do you think a butterfly effect could really possibly affect on a global scale what's happening? By the small changes?
We are in a situation where the global system, the financial system, the social system, political system, obviously nature, the ecological system, is unstable. So it's, and this situation, which is in the popular terms is known as a chaos condition, but in scientific terms it's really just a kind of a critical instability, which is not chaotic at all. It's highly ordered, but it's super, super sensitive. So what can happen is a butterfly, which means a very tiny little input, can have a very major effect on the system. And this can be to disbalance the system, to make it collapse, or to create new conditions which will make the system more resistant, you know, and more able to operate. So it can work either way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I work in litigation, and I can tell you right now that the people that I know and the people that I work with, not my friends that are involved in consciousness, but just the average businessman that walks around, they don't believe this. They don't understand how a butterfly effect could work. So could you explain a little bit how maybe macro shifts work with quantum mechanics?
Well, there is a very nice visual image that one can use for the butterfly effect, and that means a butterfly effect operates when you have an attractor, and the system, you know, that governs the attractors are the kind of models or patterns that govern the behavior of the system, and this can model. So when this attractor is a so-called chaotic attractor, also known as a strange attractor, then there is the visual image. Think of a whirlpool, you know, where water is running around in a circle, and everything is around, going around and around and around. Now you have a leaf on top of this. And the leaves will run around and round and round, you know, and it will perform a given kind of a pattern. And the pattern is not the same every time the leaf goes around in very much in detail. If you look at it in greatest detail, microscopic detail, you'll see that it's a different pattern. It's slightly different. But overall, it conforms to an overall model, a kind of a mode of behavior going around the whirlpool. Now, if you throw a pebble, smallest pebble or blow on it or whatever, you know, put a little input, then it can happen that is sufficient to dislodge the leaf from the circular pattern, and then the leaf will either go down the drain in the center or go outside of this pattern and move away to someplace completely different, you know. So it's a very super sensitive kind of a system, and that's what a butterfly effect is. It operates in a way in which these attractors, which are the strange attractors, show that they are sensitive to an input. Once even a tiny little thing happens, then that dislodges the typical pattern and something else is taking its place. Now, this doesn't happen when you have a stable system. For example, if you don't have a whirlpool, but a stream is moving downstream, for example, then it's you have a leaf going downstream. Even if you dislodge it a little bit, it's still going to go downstream. It doesn't have this very sudden change of trajectory. Yet you do have that when you have the chaotic attractors. So
that's
this can
amazing.
Be modeled. This can be simulated. It's worse in the real world.
That's an amazing analogy. So let's talk a little bit, let's back up now. I just wanted to make sure we covered that financial issue and talk about the phases of a macro shift, because most people don't realize that there's anything that's identifiable other than the flowing nature of life. So let's start with your trigger phase, if you don't mind, and let's go through these phases and explain them.
Now, the main thing to keep in mind is that when a system that's as complex as a human society or the financial system or the economic system or an ecology, any one of these systems are made up of many different components, and they all interact together, and they all are interaction with the surroundings also. So a system like this doesn't move in time in a very linear, steady, step-by-step fashion. It can move in such a way for a while. And then it can reach a point, a threshold, a critical point, and that's known as a critical instability, also known as a chaos point or a bifurcation point, or a tipping point, you know, these are different terms meaning the same thing, when the system then becomes super sensitive and all of a sudden it changes in a surprising way. It shifts. It's a kind of a quantum shift. All of a sudden it jumps, you know. And that's what I'm trying to describe in the different phases of the macro shift. That it does reach, sooner or later, it reaches that point when the sudden shift is occurring. And we are now globally on the point, on the threshold of such a sudden shift. Because sometimes it occurred in the financial system. It did occur already, you know, last week, when all of a sudden the sudden changes have kept left at us, you know, all of a sudden rose up. But in many other ways, in the ecological system and in the political system and so on, it's not yet there. But it could happen almost any moment.
So you've got the trigger, transformation, critical or chaos, breakdown, and then breakthrough. Where are we right now?
So, you know, at the beginning there is an accumulation. There is things keep changing. And it looks like they keep changing linearly. That means that you make a little change and you see the effect of it. A little input, a little output, you know, and the system responds almost in a very reliable, so-called linear fashion. As much input, as much output. So a behavior. But then you can reach a point where this accumulation is no longer able to maintain itself. The system is not able to maintain itself. Another analogy here is when you reach a point in your body, for example, when you keep getting warmer and warmer, the temperature is getting, it is heating up. For a while, one tries to cool off, one sweats, the body does all kinds of things to maintain its body temperature. If the heat would continue, after a while, you can't maintain it any longer, you know. And then, of course, there's some serious problems can occur. Same thing if it gets colder. Same thing if you have an infection. For a while, the body maintains its equilibrium. After a while, it reaches a critical point where it can't maintain its equilibrium anymore. It can't push back to its norm. And then that it reaches this tipping point, and it either reconfigures, either adapts itself in a radical fashion, restructures itself, or it goes under. And this is where we are now. Either restructure, either change, or face a collapse.
Wow. So how, you know, the population growth is a problem. You know, we get more and more every day. So how do we continue to grow? Do we grow extensive or intensive? Those are phrases you use in your book. And what do you mean by that?
Well, that's really the problem. You see, we are growing not only in absolute numbers, but in terms of per capita, you know, per person.
Mm-hmm.
We are growing by more than 80, 85 million persons additional every year at the present time, you know. But the problem is that per person, our requirements are growing. You know, so we're using more and more of the resources of the earth per individual person on the global average. Of course, the rich people use a lot more than the poor people. And the poor people also are doing great damage to the environment by inadvertently, by deforesting it and overusing it and so on. So altogether, the problem is too many people, too big appetites, too many requirements, and too much waste. Not enough efficiency in our use of our resources. That we live on a finite planet, and we have to keep an equilibrium between how much resources we have and how we use them. If we use more, then the resources can be replenished, then sooner or later we run out of the resources. It's like living on your capital. After a while, it just diminishes. After a while, it goes down to zero, and then you are in trouble. So this is where we are now. We have to face this problem.
So how do we get people to listen to this? And what, I'm sure you've put a lot of thought into how society needs to be, some suggestions of how we should move forward and how consumerism should be. So what were your suggestions about that?
You look again at the overall picture, and then each person can adapt and can think about what he or she wants to do or can do. The overall picture is not bad at all. We have tremendous resources at our disposal. We have you know, it's been said and calculated that in 40 minutes, the solar radiation that reaches the Earth, would be, if it was used for to produce commercial energy, it would produce enough energy for 1 year to all of humanity, you know, in 40 minutes' time. So we are not using that. We are using, even if we use 1% more of that, our energy problems would be solved. Same way with materials, with resources, we can recycle. We can use things much more efficiently. We can create much more equitable systems. We have all the know-how. The technologies are there, the information as to how we could handle ourselves, how we could manage our systems is there. It's all possible. We are not doing it because we have been operating in this sort of blind man's paradise of thinking that we can just keep going the same way we have been, using more and more, wasting more and more, and not worrying about creating any kind of a balance with what there is, you know. So if we could better use our technologies, better use our wisdom, we could, and we can go into detailed examples, obviously, but in every field, we could live sustainably, we could live more equitably.
I know that you are in connection with the United Nations and government heads. How do they respond to this? Do they believe it?
There is a curious situation. You know, people on the top of the political system are usually intelligent people. They wouldn't have got to where they are unless they were. At the same time, their position is such that their position is, and their power base is intimately linked with the current system. So any major change to the current system threatens their own position. So even if then they see that a change needs to happen, their position is such that they try to prevent major change from happening, and they hope that small incremental changes will do, because the major change is a threat to people who have a major stake in the system, you know. So it depends on how much integrity these people have. If they really are believe that that what they have to do is act for the human good, then they don't worry about their own personal position, and they say, okay, we have got to change. But mostly human nature is such that it says, okay, well, let me see how I can do best with the system that we have, because this is the system in which I have a good position, you know. So there's a dilemma always on the top level of the political and the business spheres.
I know that we talked a few minutes earlier, and you told me that you were going to Toronto in the spring, you hoped, to some type of emergency meeting. What is that and who's involved?
At present time, drafting a declaration that we will be presenting in the late spring, and we will invite some top level people worldwide. The idea is that we have got to mount a kind of a, whatever you want to call it, an Apollo mission, or a going to so-called war footing, although it's not a happy analogy, but something where we have to have a very major mission kind of orientation. Pulled together worldwide, because we are facing the financial crisis there, but we are facing multiple crises. The next crisis could be on energy, could be on water, could be on the climate change. It could be on terrorism or wars breaking up. We don't know where it's coming, but we cannot operate any longer with the old way of tried and tested methods of business as usual. So we've got to look at the situation in its totality and say, okay, the time has come to pull together, put aside partisan, nationalistic or party-like, bipartisan beliefs and attitudes, and say, what is it that we can do in our joint interest, the joint interest as humanity on this small and finite planet. And we're calling a meeting to say, okay, we are in an emergency situation. The time has come for to do action. These and these and these are the problems. As we'll outline these problems, they are already known, of course. It's not difficult to outline them and say, okay, all of them have solutions, but the solutions call for cooperation, and we can't do it alone, and we can't do it by just doing the old way, moving forward as we have in the past. We've got to find new ways to move forward We've got to find creative solutions and do it together. And we want to call attention to this, because people won't do it. The leadership won't be able to do this unless they have popular support. We have to have support on the broadest public. And the broadest public has to be aware of the fact that we're facing a critical situation. It's not hopeless. In fact, it offers a lot of opportunities for change that a more stable system doesn't offer. So there is a tremendously exciting time that we've got to wake up and start acting.
Are you presenting a plan?
We are making a series of recommendations, yes. They are individually nothing that it wouldn't be known. I mean, it's not that we are harboring any great secrets that would be up our sleeves. We just say that we have got new energy technologies, we have got new efficiency technologies, we have got a better way of managing our systems. All of these are known. We have got to put it together and start implementing. And not wait until there's a higher level of crisis, or perhaps the crisis will go away. It won't go away. Things are getting worse and worse if you go on the same way that we've been doing so far. So the time to act has come. The time to change has come. So this is what we're doing. We are hopefully doing that. At the same time, we are presenting a new book. It's called The Handbook for Real Change, which I have drafted on behalf of the Club of Budapest, and we're going to present this book. It's a handbook for change, as I said. And here we are outlining the problems and outlining possible actions that people can take individually on the grassroots level and on the leadership level as well.
Good. We're getting ready for presidential elections here. Have you spoken to any of our leading officials from the United States?
I try not to get involved directly in day-to-day politics. I follow it, and I believe that what we will need is a waking up on the level of the people themselves, and then they'll elect leaders who will be able to respond to their wishes. The question is, do we want to keep going the way we have up till now, or do we want to do something new, have the courage to do something new? So obviously, I hope that we'll have the courage, and then there will be people always coming up who are willing to change and to bring new blood into the system.
If everything continues as it is right now, and change doesn't occur, How long do you think we can go without some kind of radical change going on or radical emergency going on through the world?
Well, you know, nobody knows this. But I suspect that it's going to be very close to the famous end of 2012 deadline that the Mayan calendar talks about, that the Cherokees talk about, that astrologers talk about, even astronomers talk about. The increases in the solar activity at that point. So there is going to be some kind of a change occurring in 4 or 5 years' time, and that's awfully close to this famous deadline, point of not the end of the world, but the end of this world, this kind of world.
In the world as we know it.
Yeah.
End of the world as we know it.
You see, because look at it individually. You look at any trend. You used to say, for example, that the global warming by the end of the century, 2-3 degrees on the Celsius scale. You know, that used to be said a few years ago. Now, then they said it will be by 2050. Now they say it's between 5 and 15 years, and it's not 3 degrees, but 6 degrees on the Celsius scale, you know. And so every single trend that you look at, the time horizons are shortening. And on top of that, people are not even taking account the cross impact, how one thing affects another, you know, because you can't have a major situation arising in one field without it impacting on another. So this cross impact could accelerate the project, the whole process. So that's why I'm saying nobody knows, but the system is so sensitive, it's so open to butterflies, as we said, that it can trigger a crisis at almost any moment, and that we don't know how to stop that crisis. We are not sure just how we can control it anymore. So we better be prepared, prepared to change and know that what we can do to restabilize this world in which we live on a more resistant, more humane, and more sustainable manner.
I forgot what I was going to say. I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. How do you think that mind can affect all of this? Our states of mind, our cohesive mind.
Our mind, you mean?
Yes, the cohesive,
yeah.
The cohesiveness of our minds.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? You know, living a loving life, I guess, and a life with agape, or intentions, positive intentions. How much do you think that could affect the world? Or do you think it affects the world?
I think it's the ultimate decision point, the ultimate factor that will make the difference is our consciousness, is our mind, is our intention. You come down to it, you know. How we behave is always oriented toward trying to realize what we hold dear. These are our priorities, our values. We don't talk about values, but I mean the values are not fixed once and for all. The value can be just to make as much money as possible, or to become as powerful as possible, or to separate yourself up from the rest of the world and just live on your own cocoon. I mean, these are different values. Or you can be sociable, or you can want the good for people, or you want to be contribute to being to creating a sustainable world because you feel that that's your role. These are all different kind of values. And the kind of very self-centered, short-term kind of values where you want to be as rich as possible in as short a time as possible, those kind of things just take apart the current system, you know. And it doesn't help even the people who are going after it, who seem to be successful. Short-term success in the long term can mean failure. So mind is obviously is the critical factor. How do we think? What is our intention? What is our view of the world? Do we see ourselves as separate? Do we see ourselves as part of the world?
Well, you know, it's easy to say that, Urban, but a lot of people say, my thoughts are my own, and they don't understand how one's intentions can affect what's going on in the world. Do you have some science to back that up?
Well, it doesn't need to have anything very spectacular or metaphysical. Your intentions govern the way you behave. The way you behave has an effect on other people. And it can spread in this world. You know, fashion spread very fast. Behavior patterns, information is moving very fast on the world. Just the way fashion changes or a new song becomes all of a sudden a big hit. So stars are being made or being forgotten from one day to the next. Our mind, our behaviors can have a big effect on the world because it has an effect on our behavior. In addition to that, I will go further, you know. I will also say, but that's, you know, moving forward more on an abstract level. But in addition to your behavior, also the way you think influences other people's thinking. Because your one's consciousness has an effect on others, and we have seen there are lots of experiments done on parapsychology and all kinds of laboratories that shows that what goes on in one person's mind, measured by its EEG patterns, you know, the electroencephalograph patterns, can influence other people's, and even when they are not affected by the same kind of things that the first person is. In other words, we are connected in more ways than one. So what we do, what we think, has an effect in the world through our behavior, but also spontaneously in all ways. Extremely
yes.
Important how we behave, how we think,
well,
how
I was
we
thinking-
feel.
I was thinking about, you know, Bill Tiller's work with his intention machine, you know, how it changed the pH in water and accelerated the growth rate of fruit fly larvae. People don't believe that there's science to support that mind manipulates matter, but it's there, isn't it?
You know, I just came back 2 days ago from Tokyo, and among other things, I was doing a number of talks there. Among other things, I had another meeting with this Masaru Emoto, Dr. Emoto, who has done the water crystals,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we have done some experiments because I had some physicists with me as well as some natural healers, and they had their means of influencing water, what we call informing water, you know. So creating, producing information that the water conserves.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of a nice theory, but we wanted to see if the water crystals that this MO2 is producing actually show it. So we had did a number of tests. We met for a number of days there, and we had a test where first they would test the water in a plain glass of just normal water, you know. And then the same glass of water, after the physicists have influenced it, after the natural healers worked on it, and then we see that a completely different kind of crystal patterns are coming around, coming
mm-hmm.
about after that.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So it has an effect. It's very difficult to say which pattern does exactly what, but it's very clear that even positive intentions, positive emotions, or negative emotions, it all has an effect which can show in water.
Yes, yes. Now, you have a chapter in your book called the Akashic Field. We have a G field. We have an electromagnetic field. What is an Akashic Field, and how do you know it really exists?
Well, I give it a name, Akashic, because it corresponds so much to what the ancient Sanskrit and Hindi seers have talked about when they talked about Akasha as being the most fundamental of all the elements of the world, you know, more fundamental than air, water, fire, and earth. But the fifth element, which is the mother of all the other elements. So what the evidence is that things are connected, even if they're very subtly connected, things are connected over space and time. But when something happens here, it has a very subtle influence that can even be measured in certain cases on other things. It can be measured in the case of a physical system, can be measured when it comes to the behavior of our brains, you know, the nervous systems, and it can be measured statistically when it comes to a whole group behaviors. So, and then these influences also last in time. So the conclusion out of this is that information, that means the effect of one thing on the other, is not something that temporarily passes away and then it's gone. This, when something happens, it continues to have an effect in time, and it keeps spreading and has an effect in space. Now, the question is, what is it in nature that conserves this information? If the internet conserves the information, we know that there is a whole technology behind it. You know, there is electronics that conserves that information and transmits it. What is it in nature? So my proposal is, which other people have also suggested, that what we call the unified field, that most fundamental of all the fields, which contains actually the origin of all matter in the universe, is the origin of all the gravitational fields, electromagnetic fields, nuclear fields, and so on. This most fundamental field not only is an energy field, it's also an information field. It's something that maintains, conserves information, conveys information. Nature simply is not a passive, empty kind of a thing or space. This is something which is a plenum. It's there. It's filled. It's filled with information, and it's very active. So once you do something, it will produce an effect on all other things and also in the future on things. So this field, this information field, I name after Akasha, which is the most fundamental of all the elements according to the ancient seers. So I call it the Akashic field. But you could call it something else, you know. It's a quantum vacuum field or it's an aspect of unified field.
So do you think it's waves or particles or frequencies or all of the combined?
Well, I think they're all waves. Waves in particular, different frequencies and phases and amplitudes. These waves interact. They create interaction patterns, which is what really holograms are all about. They are patterns of interaction, of light beams. But the other kind of interaction that can happen, and then you have not light holograms, then you have so-called quantum holograms. And these quantum holograms have a curious property that they spread. They interact. All over space, you know, that they interact. and we can act, we can also interact with them, we can perceive, we can derive information from these quantum holograms that are there in space. So the technique, the physics of it is quite complex, but the basic principle is not. The basic principle is very simple and logical. Everything that happens it remains. Nothing vanishes completely. Nature simply has a field that maintains information.
Yes. So I want to ask you something that's not in your book. We've talked about it briefly on a phone call before, and that's the B-flat sound. Do you hear a high-pitched sound in your ears?
But the B-flat is a very, very comforting, very warm, wonderful sound. And as you know, many people claim that there is such a basic sound traveling throughout space.
Mm-hmm.
And they calculated that when there is a collapse of a galaxy into its becomes into a black hole or sometimes into a white hole, the center of the galaxy, then that creates a shock wave that is a multiple of a frequency of a B-flat.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, that's one of the natural sounds of the universe.
Do you think, let me say a couple of things here. I have that sound in my ears all the time. And so I started asking, I didn't get it until I had my enlightenment experience, and then it just came. And every serious mystic that I've interviewed that really tries to stay on a serious conscious path gets this sound in their ears. And then I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, you know, every time I've gone backpacking, because I backpack in the woods, and it's so silent, there's no sound. There's also a noise that's it's so silent that it's screaming at the same time. So I wonder if that's not the frequency of silence. You know, before there was anything in the universe, there was that sound because there was silence. And then an original intention got placed on that frequency and things started manifesting. So do you think that might could be the frequency of manifestation?
You know, Eva, I come at it a little different ways. I arrive at the same conclusion as you do, but I think about it in terms of the mechanics of it or the dynamics of it a little differently. I think, you know, a sound is a wave of the air. Now, what we hear in this kind of a direct, spontaneous way is not a sound that is conveyed by air pressure. It's a wave in this quantum field. It's a direct perception of a process that goes on in the universe that our brain is able to perceive, because as all complex systems, our brain is able to interact with other things in a mode that physicists call the quantum resonance mode. You know, it's a spontaneous mode of interaction. And I think we can pick up information, and it's count among them things that appear like sound like sound, you know, but they are not. They are actually wave patterns in space, in the world all around us. We are embedded in them. We are embedded in a complex field, just like we are embedded in an electromagnetic field. You have to have a radio or a cordless phone or a cell phone or a TV set or whatnot, and it picks up these things. They wouldn't know it otherwise unless you had this.
Right.
So your brain can transform some of these complex patterns into images, into sounds. So this is what happens. They are there. Information is there all around us. We just don't ordinarily repress it. We don't ordinarily perceive it. But when you're particularly sensitive, you can actually feel some of these things.
Have you met anybody else that's aware of information or studying this thing with B-flat? Because I've noticed that when I get, like, in a deep form of meditation and I focus on an intention, if I have that sound really loud in my ear, that thing occurs very quickly. Have you met anybody else?
That's a tuning phenomenon. That's, you know, like when standard meditation practices to say Om, you know, the deep sound. And if Tibetan monks can produce a very deep throat sound. And all that tunes the brain. If you then would measure the EEG patterns in the brain, you know, the way the electric functions of your hemispheres, you would find that they get highly synchronized, they get harmonic patterns. And the left and the right hemisphere become become highly synchronized, then you get these basic sounds, and you concentrate on the sounds, or produce those sounds, or listen to those sounds. So this is a tuning phenomenon. It's like you have a well-tuned instrument, you know, it produces much more harmonic sounds. You need to tune, or you tune a fine receiver, you know, your radio receiver. You can pick up a radio broadcast from the other end of the earth. So you need to tune your brain, and then you pick up information. And the sound, I suspect, the B-flat, is like ohm. It's a way of tuning your brain to become a super-sensitive receiver.
That's interesting. So we got a couple of minutes left. What would you like to talk about that we've not already discussed?
Gosh, I think we've discussed a lot of things. What strikes me, you know, Eva, is that things are coming together in a very interesting fashion. We are facing unparalleled challenges, dangers, at the same time opening new opportunities. And we are also facing a tremendous evolution in our mind, in our consciousness. And the two things come together. And at the same time, this evolution of consciousness is supported at the leading edge of the sciences. You mentioned Bill Tiller, but a lot of people are now working on this cutting-edge science, which shows that there are subtle connections, and that there is information, and that we can, what I call it coming home to the universe. You know, we can become part again of this coherent sound or coherent harmony that is there in nature, in the cosmos. And so all these things are coming together. So at the same time, we are facing grave dangers, which could even lead to a catastrophe that could spell the end of humanity. At the same time, we are opening up new channels, new ways of thinking, new technologies, and new feelings, which could bring us together into a higher level of evolution. We could move forward as a species into higher civilization. So it's a very, very exciting time, a tipping point down or a tipping point up. And finally, it's in last analysis, it's each and every one of us, which way we go.
So let me talk about the Mayan calendar for a minute, because nobody really talks about that from a scientific perspective or as broadly as you do. What do you think that means? The Mayan calendar or all of these other mystics that have things to say about 2012, what does that mean to humanity?
Well,
what do they think is
going
to happen? I was going to say, you know, a lot of people think that consciousness will suddenly take a quantum leap, and what will that mean? If you saw James Redfield's movie, you know, suddenly the people that were focused, that had positive, more evolved consciousness, suddenly the rest of the world couldn't see them. They were still there, but they couldn't see them. You know, the atoms were vibrating faster or something. So what does that mean to you, 2012?
I suspect that there is reaching a critical point or a tipping point by about that time. And because there are so many people are concentrated on this date, on December 21, 2012, and because at the same time, we can expect real physical phenomena occurring, like solar activity, sunspots so intense that to some extent, for a couple of weeks, even telecommunications will be practically impossible.
Really?
That's serious to forecast. A lot of things are coming together, and it's very likely that the collective psyche of humanity, that we have a kind of a collective mind, a mindset that is shared by people, is expecting something to happen. And when something is coming to a critical point there, you know, it could mean a butterfly, could mean a very serious butterfly, which means that people's, all of a sudden, mentality would change, and that people would they become angels or metaphysics or whatever, but they become much more aware people, much more awakened, much higher levels of solidarity, much higher levels of belongingness, and perhaps love, yes. I mean, there's more love will come into the world. death would be on the positive side. If you don't kill each other, if you don't allow everything to go down the drain, I think there will come a positive change of that kind. And then we can really move to a new kind of civilization, which will be based on sharing more than on just accumulating one's own personal short-term interests. I think a phase change like that is possible.
You know, Noetic Science has just completed, I can't remember if it's a 20-year or a 30-year study, I can't remember, but they just completed a study that where they found that there were more spontaneous enlightenments occurred in the early 90s than ever before in the history of time. Do you know anything about that?
I heard about that. There is certainly a phenomenon that is increasing awareness. I think this phenomenon actually occurring all the time. The people are repressing it. You know, I have, if you allow me, I'll mention it. I'm just now finishing a book that has contributions by 20 people, 20 top-level scientists. Our whole book is about what I call Akashic experiences of intuition, you know, that turn out to be, have a real mind and life-transforming effect. And these are intuitions that are not just subjective, just set in your mind. They are really perceptions of the world that don't go through our eyes and our ears. You know, they're more spontaneous, more direct. And now we finally have also some, from quantum physics, some explanations how this kind of thing is possible. So I think this, what turns out is that when you ask people, and like I've done with these 20 people, did you have anything like this happening to you? And would you describe it? Then people say, yes, something did. Things like that did happen. And then they describe really mind-shaking, mind-transforming, life-transforming experiences. They're far more frequent than we would think. They happen to many more people than we would think. And this is intensifying.
Do you have any idea what could cause such a radical shift in the blink of an eye like that from a scientific perspective? Is it an increase in your vibratory rate or is it sunspots? What could cause something to happen like that in the blink of an eye? While you're walking down the street, for example, or in your sleep?
You know, you can think of it having an external natural cause or a human cause. If you think about it as a natural cause, a physics cause, yes, there could be an increase in the frequency of the geomagnetic radiation, for example, sunspot activity. There could be a number of things happening in the complex field around us. It could also be just they're overloading the electromagnetic field with information, and also that's affecting our nervous system. You know, there are many different possibilities externally. But I'm also thinking that something much more intrinsic, inherent, could be happening. That when humanity is approaching such a critical watershed like we are now, that this has an effect on all of us. You know, when this kind of animals called the lemmings, they are famous because when they reach a point of overpopulation, they commit collective suicide. It's other mice, when they have an overpopulation, then they become infertile. Entire species behave in a way which altogether acts in favor of their whole species. Because the lemmings don't commit suicide because of the extinction of the species. They just get rid of the overpopulation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it may be that when we're reaching this point of a threat to our very survival, then our collective psyche, our individual nervous systems are being affected by all other nervous systems on this planet. And so humanity as a whole is responding. Humanity as a whole has something like an immune system. I'm convinced of that. And this immune system is beginning now to operate. It pumps more hormones, metaphorically, into the system, and we are beginning, each of us, feeling that. And so we are beginning each to respond to this overall threat to our collective well-being, to our collective survival. And each of us, whether we know it consciously or not, are beginning to respond.
That's an interesting perspective. Makes a lot of sense. So we got about 8 minutes. You want to talk about the Club of Budapest and where people can find it on the internet and what they can do to participate?
Well, I mean, you can find it on the internet. We are doing a number of publications. We are doing some research on the new cultures, on the emerging cultures. We are promoting actions that lead to sustainability. We are just now going to publish, in the spring actually, going to publish a handbook which gives you very concrete ideas about not only what is wrong, what are the problems, but what each of us can do about it. And so we are trying to motivate on the whole this collective change of mindset, evolution of consciousness. And they can join it. There are national associations in different parts of the world. There are now 17 countries in the world that have Club of Budapest, and one can become members of that. And so I suggest people look it up at the clubofbudapest.org and then get information on how they can join it as members.
I've never asked anybody this question, but for some reason I want to ask you. Have you changed the way you live your life, the material part of your life? Do you do those things you need to do? Recycle?
Well, I first taught at the State University of New York. I lived in New York, out in the country. Then I moved to New York City and worked for the UN for 7 years. I lived in the middle of Manhattan. Then I decided to move out for a year, and that was 20 years ago. I moved out for a year out into the country house, in an old farmhouse in Tuscany. And this is where I stayed. And I live here now, and I just don't have any interest in this kind of things that use a lot of energy, use a lot of resources. My house produces its own energy. It's photovoltaics. It produces its own hot water. We have a vegetable garden. I think it's a much more natural kind of living. Of course, I have all the information set up here so I can communicate with people. I just find myself spontaneously much more willing, much more ready, much more enjoying living a natural, healthy, and open life rather than being part of a rat race that I also used to be part of.
I would imagine it's a much higher quality of life.
I think it is. A much simpler life, but a much, much higher quality.
I think so, too. So is there anything else you want to talk about that we've not covered? Are you aware of any new research going on? Are you aware of any, are you involved in any other organizations to try to motivate the world?
Well, we're going to join forces. One of the things we do at the Club of Budapest is creating networks. We're creating, for example, Europe, we have now kind of a yellow pages, a holistic network that people can join, and we hope to bring that into the U.S. We are creating an internet-based alliance. The concept we are using increasingly now is the single term world shift, which is a worldwide shift from a negative to a positive path, from a breakdown to a breakthrough path. So we're talking about World Shift. We have a World Shift Foundation, which you can find on the internet. And we have a World Shift Alliance, where the people can, individuals and organizations can join. So this is all part of the same idea that we have been talking all along. We are reaching a point where little stepwise movements forward don't take you anymore. We have reached the point where either structural change occurs and occurs in time or the system will break down. So we are trying for the past 25 years at least, we have been trying to do this, and now people are beginning to recognize that this is not just talk, this is real. That what we've been talking about, it might happen, the future is beginning to happen. So I'm happy about the level of awareness that is rising in the world. I am very concerned about the dangers that are occurring, but the two things go together. Both the danger and the response to the danger go together. It just means that we have got to win this particular fight you've got to respond before the danger becomes critical.
What about our health care? Or do you promote or support alternative medicine? Are you
absolutely?
Are you
I have not taken allopathic medicine myself for over 20 years.
That was
if
my
I need
question.
Something, I use homeopathy. But I'm being treated, for example, by a healer who is far away from me in another country, and she knows me very well. And she can find out what's happening in my organism, you know, and can, if necessary, send healing information. And if that doesn't work, then or it's not sufficient, then tell me what kind of homeopathic remedies I can use. And if I had anything wrong for the past over 20 years, this is what's been happening. And I've not had anything seriously happening to me, you know. And I believe that a natural way of living, a natural diet, you know, a good, I also for over 20 years I've been vegetarian, and a healthy living is the key. I mean, you don't need a lot of fancy medication if you can use food as your remedy, if you use clean air, as much as possible. So we have got to try to live the way that our bodies were meant to live, you know, for the past 100,000 years, and not the way we've been living over the past 50 years.
Does your organization ever discuss genetically modified foods? What's your opinion about genetically modified foods and starving nations?
Well, there's a tremendous promise there. You know, if you look at what people say about how promising individual things are, the problem with the GM modification is that it looks at the individual thing, at one thing at a time, single factor. You can produce a corn, for example, that's more resistant, more plentiful, feeds more people. But when you look at its overall effect, it can be that it destroys diversity. It can be that it becomes more energy intensive. It can be that it changes people grow food or eat. So it has a lot of side effects.
Yes,
the famous ecologist Garrett Hardick said that you can't do just one thing, and that applies also to genetic modification. I mean, you try to do one thing, and it does a thousand other things, which you can't control.
Yes, it does.
I'm altogether apprehensive about it. I would hope that by using good organic methods, you can produce all the food and all the healthy things that you need instead of doing it in a lot of fancy technological ways.
Do you discuss this with the nations when you go to meet with them?
Well, if I'm asked, I talk about it. I try not to get into any partisan politics or partisan business. I say what is on my mind and let people respond and let people come to their own conclusions.
Well, we're out of time, Dr. Laszlo. Thank you so much for being with me today and taking the time away from your son. I appreciate it.
Well, it was a pleasure as always, Eva, and it was a great opportunity to talk about things that are close to our hearts.
Well, I'm always here. My show's always open to you. Agape, and good night.